Science Skepticism: Why So Many Reasonable People Mistrust Scientific Evidence. The well-known doctor and author Atul Gawande gave the commencement address at Caltech last Friday and devoted his remarks to the growing mistrust of science. He ended his speech to the new graduates by saying, quote, "We are not just battling for what it means to be scientists. We are battling for what it means to be citizens." Many people agree with Gawande that the stakes are extremely high as we make policy decisions that affect the planet in the future. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss science skepticism. What are some of the historic and sociological reasons for it? How is it connected to religion, politics, and other powerful forces? And what can be done to address a culture increasingly mistrustful of scientific evidence? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. When Galileo declared that the Earth orbits the sun, he was scoffed at and put on trial. The same skeptical reaction has greeted scientists' findings for centuries. Today, people continue to question what scientific research says about climate, vaccinations, genetically modified foods, and more. Why does the public often choose to doubt or distrust science? Today, we explore attitudes towards science and medicine. Skepticism is more prevalent today than in Galileo's time. With me in the studio, David Hecht. He's assistant professor of history at Bowdoin College, and his research looks at public attitudes towards science. Ivan Fernandez is a professor of soil science at the University of Maine, and he does research on climate change. And Dr. Laura Blaisdell is a pediatrician with Intermed and a clinical study coordinator with the National Children's Study. Her research looks at attitudes towards vaccinations. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
As always, we want to hear from you. Do you believe that scientific data is to be trusted? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. People who doubt science, as we mentioned, are nothing new, but recent research shows that a public mistrust of science is increasing. David Hecht, you're a historian with an interest in public attitudes towards science. Has this been a phenomenon throughout time, or is there really something about today's society that makes people even more skeptical about science?
Maybe a little bit of both. You certainly, by mentioning Galileo, hit it exactly right. Science skepticism has been around for centuries. What we think of as science is maybe a couple hundred years old. And from the start, there are people who like what scientists have had to say and don't like it. And people who don't like it are going to be skeptical of it. But there does seem to be, I'm not sure if it's more science skepticism now, but certainly greater stakes around it as science has gotten more and more authoritative, more and more well-funded, more and more privileged. There's a lot more at stake for those people who don't like it for whatever reason.
Okay. As far as climate change goes, Ivan Fernandez, in your work as a climate scientist, what do you think is going on? Why is this debate so persistent?
Well, just in thinking about the topic, I'm torn between whether it's a distrust of science or whether it's a divided opinion on science, since those that feel like the science is supporting their position on aspects of climate change will embrace the science and every little aspect of science, and others will reject it wholeheartedly. There's a lot of information floating around, and it's not just the traditional conduits of science delivery to outlets for scientists and the public. And so figuring out where to get your science and how to interpret the science is a big challenge.
So maybe just the how much information we're all getting, trying to absorb every day,
right,
is part of it.
Big topics like climate change, they're both political, they're important for the future of the planet, and they're complicated. And just what is climate change, which we could get into later, but what's the boundaries of that topic? It's actually quite broad, and I think the differences in opinion vary across that spectrum.
Laura Blaisdell, you work with doctors and with patients trying to get more people vaccinated, but, you know, there are so many people choosing not to vaccinate their children now. And one thing that's interesting, and I think we've discussed this before, is these are in really highly educated communities often. What are you learning about folks that are skeptical of getting a vaccination for their children or getting vaccinations for their children?
I think you hit it on the head saying that these are we tend to focus on people who are skeptical to vaccinations. There are certain reasons why people don't get vaccinations. Either they don't have access or for other reasons. But my research tends to focus on people who have some hesitancy about vaccinating their children. And my research really focuses on how can two very well-educated people look at the same data and come to vastly different conclusions. And I think that people who are questioning vaccines are looking at science and feeling like there's ambiguity in the data in ways that other people, as Ivan was saying, can look and feel that they can find certainty in the data. And so parsing out why people might see certainty or ambiguity in the data is something that's very interesting to decision-making sciences these days.
Is part of it in the language of science? The idea that that scientist David never say, I know with 100% certainty that this is so, because that's not how scientists speak.
I think that's part of it. And I think that can be combined with an expectation that a lot of non-scientists have that science can produce certain knowledge. So when there are conflicting reports or when a study comes out that challenges even in small part a different study, that suggests some uncertainty about the knowledge. And there's a little bit of almost cognitive dissonance where people are like, well, I thought science was supposed to be objective and true and definite. You know, and so then when people realize that that isn't quite true, it might lead them to not only get a little bit of doubt, but get a lot more doubt than is actually called for by the data.
Okay, so you use the phrase cognitive dissonance, and I think that this is really interesting because in the reading that I did to prepare for this show, the name Leon Festinger kept popping up. This is a Stanford University psychologist in the 50s that was studying why people believe things and don't believe things. And he talked about this idea of cognitive dissonance, but also people that like to find evidence to support what they already believe. And that's a little bit what you were talking about, Ivan, the idea that I'm going to believe what supports the evidence that supports what I already think to be true or already feel to be true, the motivated reasoning. Mm-hmm. This is going on. And Ivan and Laura, you're both nodding. Are you finding this, Laura, with the parents you talk to, that they have this instinctive feeling that getting four shots or a shot with, you know, MMR shot has got to be not good for my tiny baby. Therefore, I'm going to believe the evidence that supports what I instinctively feel.
Yeah. I mean, I think when parents feel a sense of ambiguity in the data, and certainly as David was talking about, the public might not realize how scientific knowledge is created. It's an iterative process, and we learn something from each new study that goes on beforehand. And so when a tweet comes out that's 250 characters that says, this is how the world is now, and scientists wouldn't speak that way, but in the next week something else comes out, parents start to feel like the data is changing and they can't trust it. When people feel like they can't trust data, they seek out other information sources, and they do tend towards finding information sources that support their point of view, as we all do, as I do. And so I think it's really important to realize that that parents are doing the very best that they can to find information, but they might not be able to necessarily trust scientific information when they make their decisions and go into kind of a gut check type of place.
And Ivan, I'm wondering if with climate change, I remember years and years ago talking with a climate scientist, and I believe one of your colleagues at UMaine, saying, you know, scientists in general don't like to be political. They don't like to talk about policy. They like to do their work and produce their findings. And yet there was such alarm over the public not being as, you know, I'm talking 20 years ago, that in the scientific community, there was alarm over climate change, but they didn't seem to see that in the public and started speaking out. And And I'm wondering if you agree with that, and if so, if you feel as though if scientists had started earlier, been willing to put themselves out there in the public sphere with their findings earlier, if the conversation would be different.
Well, a couple thoughts. One is I think there's a spectrum from scientists, both based on their discipline and their personality, that want to do their science and publish the work and talk to other scientists, but keep it there. Once it's out there, others have the responsibility to interpret it, all the way to scientists that are scholars of the interface between science and decision-making, et cetera. I'm at the University of Maine. It's the land-grant university of the state of Maine, so a lot of our science is applied, engaging with stakeholders and trying to make a difference relative to how that science informs management and policy, what have you. So I think there's all types in that regard. On the climate, on the question you asked, however, I'm one included that feels like 2 decades ago we had plenty of information to make decisions, sound decisions, at the federal level about climate change. And so we've been in an era now where we have a lot of information, and people sometimes point to components of information saying, just get this one more piece of fact out there, you know, that one more melting glacier is going to convince the world. And it really is just supporting those that are focusing on that as evidence of climate change, and the ones that are ignoring all the evidence just ignore that as well. So you have these two different camps, and some of that is the echo chamber effect. You have to work hard to hear the other side in order to get that perspective. And there seems to be, I don't know, historically, David can certainly address that, but a lot more of sort of the E.O. Wilson's tribes, you know, we've separated and you pick your tribe and then you just follow the platform. You're really not making a decision individually.
You believe what your tribe believes.
Pretty much, yeah. And I feel like I see a lot of that. You know, it's hard to have a discussion about components based on the science if someone's sort of from another tribe on a different agenda.
David, what does history tell us about this, and how much of this scientific skepticism is tied to people's political views or the religious beliefs or other dividing lines?
So on the second part of that question, a lot. On the issue of scientists' interface with the public, there have been a lot of different models of this over the years. Like in the middle part of the 20th century, right after World War II, certainly a lot of scientists very much felt it was their responsibility to speak out and also to make explicit connections between what they saw as scientific reality and specific policy proposals. That ebbed a little bit. You know, we're talking like a generation later where a lot of scientists sort of moved towards saying, my responsibility is to publicly engage, but not so much to dictate policy, but just to provide information, as if the information itself will lead inexorably to the right policy. So I would say alongside like what I've been saying about different conceptions of whether or not scientists should be involved, there's a question of how they should be involved and really a whole spectrum of ways that scientists can choose to publicly engage. And that has changed, over the years.
All right. Laura, one thing I learned recently is that, and correct me if I've got my timing wrong, but even within medicine, when there's a new finding or a new protocol, it often takes a decade between when that's first applied successfully in a hospital setting or, you know, in a clinic and then to when it becomes widespread. So even within the community of scientists that are medicine, there's reluctance to change.
I think some of it could be reluctance to change, and some is the complexity of the healthcare system that we're in. It takes a very long time to go from bench research to policy and practice changes, and that's the whole concept of translational research that is being very well funded right now, is how do we get scientific information into the community. But I wanted to also talk a little bit about the last comment that Yvonne was talking about being part of a tribe and the concept of motivated reasoning, which is emotion-based decision-making phenomenon, where people respond to scientific data in ways that justify their pre-existing beliefs. And I think this is what I see a lot in vaccination in my area, that it's not really an issue of more information. As Yvonne said, a lot of the information about climate change has been out for a long time. Vaccine data is not new. The safety of vaccines is not new. But it's really, I find a lot of this kind of what has been known as a backfire effect, this concept that when in the face of contradictory evidence, our established beliefs become stronger. In fact, instead of being open to hearing the other side, we actually become more entrenched in our views. And I think that that's a very interesting effect that I've had to work with a one-on-one in the exam room with people to kind of deconstruct the emotionality around decision-making and really once again step back and look at data.
How have you or other docs successfully changed someone's view? What is a good strategy for overcoming this emotional reaction?
I think there are very core common human values, and I like to start there. I think we all want our world to be a healthy place. I think we want our children to be healthy. And so it's important to find those common core values, no matter what tribe we're in, and start there. So oftentimes I'll start with parents by asking, what's important to you? What data has resonated with you? And I start there in lieu of spewing more medical information that might not really help the conversation come to a fruitful or a conclusion for either of us.
All right. Is there, David, was there ever a golden age? Was there ever a time when people looked up to scientists and treated their word as gospel? Or have they always been doubted?
I think there's always been a healthy amount of doubt. You can certainly find eras in which specific sciences have been, you know, trusted, right? Like, you know, during the Cold War, scientists who had anything to do with national defense and nuclear weapons, they tended to have a lot of kind of cultural capital. People believed what they wanted to say, what they said. You can, I think, you know, personally, I'd question, though, whether that is actually sort of deference to those scientists, or whether it's just they happen to believe in the particular political goals those scientists were supporting. And so what looks like scientific deference is actually just political agreement. You know, but you can certainly find periods where it at least looks like, where there's less open debate about it, you know, but it's not common.
Okay. Well, yeah. What an interesting conversation. I can't believe we already have to go to a break. We're talking about science skepticism. This is Maine Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Nason Healthcare, providing integrated services in Springvale, Biddeford, and at Noble High School in North Berwick. NasonHealthcare.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss O.J. Made in America, a new 7.5-hour documentary series about the O.J. Simpson trial and the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. It premiered Saturday on ABC and runs this week on ESPN. We talk with filmmaker Ezra Edelman and Jeffrey Toobin, author of The Run of His Life, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. Join us.
Tune in tonight at 7 o'clock. June is Music That Moves Me Month, featuring audio diaries from people across Maine talking about a specific piece of music that has inspired them or impacted their lives in some way. All of these audio diaries are being archived at mpbn.net. You can click on events to find that. And we invite you to submit a story of your own at music@mpbn.net. And once again this month, we are collecting band instruments for needy youth. We're accepting donated instruments at our Bangor, Lewiston, and Portland locations. So if you have a clarinet in the attic, now's the time. For more information about Music That Moves Me, visit mpbn.net and click on events.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, science and science skepticism. With me in the studio, Laura Blaisdell, a pediatrician with Intermed who studies this, especially when it comes to vaccinations. David Hecht, an assistant professor of history at Bowdoin College, and Ivan Fernandez, professor of soil science at the University of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Already a full board of calls and emails and Facebook posts. But we want to go to Peter Verley. He's a cardiologist based in Bangor. Peter, can you hear me?
you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Peter, you, thank you so much for suggesting this as a topic for a program. Why is this topic so important for you, and what do you see in your work as a cardiologist?
Well, I've thought about this for a long time because we deal with this every day in seeing patients in the office. You know, the questions always come up. Why do I need to take this medication? What, you know, why are you recommending this? And I think it has become more of a phenomenon recently where people are very skeptical about things that we say. I think part of that is due to the occasional, you know, bad apple, a physician who kind of takes advantage of the system and uses their training as kind of a platform to promote themselves. I'm not going to mention any names, but you can probably all see these people on their own television shows. But I was listening to the discussion before I came on here with Laura and David and Ivan, and this thing kind of went in a different direction, or several different directions from what I expected. But this idea that we have a belief in something, and we stick to that belief no matter what the evidence is, and we only look for the evidence to support our opinions, that is very strong in patients who come into the office, and it often will take a lot of counseling, you know, a lot of discussion to try to get somebody to see the, you know, why we recommend certain treatments or certain medications.
Well, Peter, I'll throw this to you, and I'm going to throw this to our guests as well. Do you think, especially in medicine, some of it is because advice has changed over the years? I think about my mother, who was advised not to breastfeed me, and the changing recommendations on eggs and cholesterol, that people have seen things that are important in their lives have changed so that they're skeptical of other things that you might be telling them.
Well, The evidence does change, and that's part of the scientific training. You know, I think everybody on that panel there will agree that physicians and engineers and PhD scientists have a pretty rigorous scientific training that most people really do not have any idea what's involved in that and how much in-depth that is, or how in-depth that is. We tend to believe, I think, scientists who or people who have recommendations to us that are more immediate and are more easy to understand. So, for example, no one is going to question an airline pilot who is flying you to an airport in bad weather. We're not going to get up and say, you know, I think this pilot should fill the tanks with peanut butter instead. We just don't do that. We trust the pilot, and we know that he's got the training to get us to the airport. But for something that's not quite immediate like that, you know, say vaccines or climate change, no one's going to, the Earth isn't going to suddenly explode tomorrow, and you're not going to see the results of a vaccination or the lack of benefit of not getting a vaccination for many years. So the lack of immediacy, I think, is one thing that kind of gives a little bit of room for people to question the science behind it.
David.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, that the lack of immediacy or visibility of something makes it a lot easier to have a skepticism about it. So like if you look at some of the major points of skepticism of science about evolution or about climate change, right? These are, or even about vaccines, I hadn't thought of that one in this regard, but I think it's absolutely right that you can't see it as clearly as you can the plane landing, right? Or the object falling to the ground in case of gravity, right? And so when you can't see the particular scientific theory and can't grasp it and it's not as tangible, it's a lot easier to doubt it, right?
Yeah.
The other point I would make is the science behind landing airplanes is no more rigorous than the science behind developing vaccines. I mean, it is. I don't understand immunology and how those vaccine trials were done, but I know that there were some very bright people who looked for every possible, you know, crack in the logic. I think the other thing the public doesn't understand is all the criticism and skepticism that scientists have when we see new ideas or new theories. And it takes sometimes many years for the thinking to change on a certain thing. You know, we used to think that estrogen and progesterone were good for women, for postmenopausal women, at preventing heart disease, until somebody actually did the study and said, wait a minute, estrogen and progesterone in postmenopausal women actually causes heart disease.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Peter, thank you so much for suggesting this show idea. It's a terrific one, as evidenced by all the calls that are waiting. So I'm going to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much. And that was Peter Verley, who is a cardiologist in Bangor. We're going to move on to Lee, who's also calling from Bangor. Hi, Lee. Go ahead. Go ahead, Lee. Can you hear me? I'm sorry, Lee. I had clicked the wrong button. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
You'd mentioned at the beginning Galileo, and I look at him as a pure scientist. But when I think one of the problems that we're facing today is the pharmaceutical industry or the large chemical industries like Monsanto and Bayer, who are doing GMOs, or we also made some reference to climate change and the Koch brothers and their lobbyists. Money has entered in a big way into science these days. For example, the pharmaceutical industry suggested, in fact insisted and lobbied for, pure protection against any lawsuits when it comes to vaccines. And when they can produce vaccines and not worry about the consequences of a vaccine that might have a side effect, something like thimerosal in the flu vaccine, for instance, they're given a free pass. And so they're really in it for the money. And likewise with Monsanto and Bayer and the GMOs, pure science would say that Roundup is eventually, the plants are going to adapt to Roundup. And so they will only be putting more and more Roundup in their product in order to kill the weeds. But in the meantime,
sure. And you know, you're not the only one with this comment. We also have a Facebook post from Heather who says, I'd say corporate interests make me skeptical, not of science, but of its corruption. Laura, do you hear this from patients?
Certainly. And I think that a good, healthy sense of skepticism is important to maintain balance. Certainly, even 10 years ago when I was in my training, pharmaceutical representatives were allowed in our clinics, and no longer is that true. When I conduct research, I need to do a release of information about all the different interests that I might have in my research, including those that are of a business nature. But I think it's important to realize when the pharmaceutical industry is doing something on the behalf of public health, like the creation of vaccines, which the pharmaceutical industry makes nearly zero money on vaccines, but they are essential to a cornerstone to our public health. Back in the 80s and 90s, when the pharmaceutical industries were being sued for that, the government had to step in because we were having widespread vaccine shortages because the pharmaceutical industries just stepped out. So it is important to realize that a healthy sense of skepticism to the pharmaceutical industries and corporate America is certainly important. And they also sometimes provide essential medicines that we need to maintain our health.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Evan. So I would agree. I think, obviously the money in politics and money in science, the corporate dollars add to the amount of information overload that people are experiencing, and often biasing it in one direction or another. On the climate issue, I think what is climate change? Strictly it's the long-term average of weather, and it has to do with fossil fuel combustion, and that's where the fossil fuel private sector comes in relative to the debate. But climate change more broadly is everything that's happening around us as a result of the changing climate. Some of that is tangible. It's not as abstract. What happens at 2100 is abstract. Warming Gulf of Maine waters and washed out roads and changing farm pests, those are real and those are now. And those are part of climate change, but they're not the poster of climate change relative to the warming, and they're not at the cusp of the debate that's often driven by money on both sides.
Well, the sense that I have, and I really don't want to make the whole program about climate change, but that the thinking has shifted, that a lot of the people who used to be skeptical of the whole concept of climate change now say, oh, yes, I acknowledge that the coastline, the seas are rising, and I acknowledge there's a risk of ocean acidification, and I see these big storms, but it's not necessary. I don't think there's proof that it's caused by man.
Right.
I think that's the change.
I think you're absolutely right. And over the last 5 or 6 years, actually between two assessment reports for Maine that we've done, the first one, people were coming in the room saying, what's this? Is climate change real? Now they're coming in with their own stories. But depending often on their political persuasion, that's what determines how much they think human contributions are causing the climate change. But they, at that point, you could say they believe in climate change because they're living it, and it's now, and it's very real.
You get into some interesting things, too, about what constitutes proof, right? That if, like, what level of certainty do you need in order to act or believe something or propose policy, right? And it is rarely, if ever, the case that something is 100% certain before policymakers decide to act on it. So in some sense, the idea of proof is a little bit of a red herring because there's always, like you were saying earlier, there's always one more glacier we could melt or one more vaccine trial we can run, or there's always one more thing you could do.
Well, and I think that's what I was trying to get to earlier when I was talking about the language of scientists. Scientists don't say this is proven. They don't.
Right.
You don't say that when you're talking to other scientists.
Could I just interject? Yeah. I've been asked a number of times in different forums talking about climate change, isn't there disagreement among scientists? And my response is, if you've ever gone to a scientific conference and it's all scientists talking to each other, that's all we're doing is debating with each other about our science and calling into question aspects of our interpretation. That's the nature of science. There's rarely absolutes in that regard. So that is part of the science. It's never 100%. We're hesitant to say anything's absolute. But some things build up enough evidence that we make decisions based on that preponderance of evidence within the scientific data.
Okay, we have so many calls. I'm going to try to get to some more. Go ahead, Nathan in Owl's Head.
Hi, I wanted to make the comment that basic science literacy in our country is pretty low to begin with, and that doesn't help. But also, I think that many people don't understand that when a scientific discovery is made, it's not a scientist running out of a lab shouting, "Eureka!" These discoveries are published in journals which are usually peer-reviewed, which means that the data is heavily scrutinized before it stands up to the test that says, yeah, we can publish this and make this information public. So I just would like the guests to comment on those things.
Yeah, no, absolutely agree. And I think one important thing about science literacy is that it's easy to hear the phrase science literacy and think that it's about knowing the correct information. Right, but very often I think what we're up against with science skepticism is a form of science illiteracy that doesn't fully understand what science is as an investigative mode or a process of understanding. And this is what I was thinking earlier when you were talking just a minute ago, Ivan, that like the fact of vigorous debate and disagreement at a scientific meeting, if you're scientifically literate, you will not read that disagreement as inducing skepticism. Mm-hmm. You'll read it as what should be happening.
Right.
Yeah.
I also think that as physicians who are doing science and research, we also have an ethical obligation to move on information that we find that we would want to know. And it is unethical to withhold information that is trending to be true. For instance, say there was a cancer trial and it looked as if there was a cure for cancer, that would be something I would want my mother to know about. And that would be, even though we are not feeling certain, we feel that as scientists that we have an ethical obligation to move information forward, even if we aren't 100% certain.
And David, we have an email that agrees with your point. This is from Lisa, who is a teacher. She says, I can't call in during your show as I'll be teaching, but after 10 years as a science teacher, I have a strong perspective on the topic of, quote, believing in science. Science transcends itself. It traffics in proof, not faith. Tragically, students in the past generation or two have not been served by the same math and science teaching that benefited their parents and grandparents, the baby boomers. Current federal funding for science, technology, and math education is less than half of what it does during the Cold War. She goes on, but she says if students don't learn how science works at an early age, they're not likely to understand the public policy issues that turn around the sciences. It's interesting to me that you use the example of the Manhattan Project, because that was when, wasn't it, when science education was sort of at its apex in this country.
Yeah, I think about the Manhattan Project sort of served it's sort of it's like a very problematic model. It's a double-edged sword for science education in this country, because on the one hand, it served as this sort of shining example of what could be done with a lot of money and a lot of resources. On the other hand, it served perhaps to bias a little bit perceptions of science and to assume that it could be a little bit more directed than it sometimes can be, that it's a little bit, in some sense, easier and to control, that if it glorifies it. And a lot of, I'm a historian, so I don't know this firsthand, but a lot of the everyday work of science is sort of messy and unexciting and not all that glamorous. And I think that, it's hard to, I would imagine, particularly at the secondary levels of science education, it would be hard to simultaneously get students excited about that process and be honest about what it is at the same time.
Okay, well, we do have to take another short break. Would we return more of your comments and questions about science skepticism? Stay with us.
You make Maine calling possible, as does Casella, dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint. Casella, giving resources new life. And South Street Linen, women's clothing all in linen and made in Maine at 5 South Street in Portland or online at southstreetlinen.com.
When Eddie Meltzer's friends were killed at Pulse Nightclub, he decided to put his pain to use, translating for victims' families who only speak Spanish.
Constantly thinking that these parents could have been my parents, and that was tearing me apart.
I'm Ari Shapiro, reporting from a grieving, resilient city. The latest from Orlando on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon at 4 o'clock. Maine Public Radio would like to remind all teachers and educators that there is a valuable educational resource you may be interested in. Our PBS Learning Media Service contains extensive digital and classroom-ready resources. This free K-12 educational resource can be found online at mpbn.net and is aligned with Common Core and national standards. PBS Learning Media, online at mpbn.net.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, how do we explain today's skepticism about science? Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Ivan, I want to return to the very beginning of this program when you were talking about the amount of information coming at us, and that might be a big part of why people are so skeptical, that there's only so much information that we can take in. But there's sort of another side to that coin in which scientists may be feeling themselves under attack when they do provide information.
Well, there's been some stories in the news that people may be aware of, but I think that is true, that there's a potential if you step out to talk about your science more, you're subject to the potential for often, freedom of information kinds of requests or legal suits, all within the context of our system. But the risk is that you get bogged down in just dealing with that, which is intended simply to slow down the process of science and getting science out there, which is inevitably driving some scientists to not try and convey the information that they have in places that they think it might be useful.
Mm. So we're going to go to John, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. You sort of already answered my question about skepticism, and that skepticism in itself is not a bad thing because it's part of the scientific method. Questioning things is important. But I had a secondary question, I guess. The secondary question I had is, why are the scientists now using global warming versus what used to be called, climate change versus what used to be called global warming?
Global warming's always been one, the actual warming of the atmosphere has always been just one component of the changing climate system. And initially that was the focus. And so we talked about global warming essentially after the Clean Air Act reauthorization in 1990, the federal focus of research shifted from acid rain to global change. And so we've gone through this era of global change, global warming, climate change, but truly climate change is encompassing changing patterns of precipitation, of temperature, as well as the chemical change, rising CO2 and changes in ozone, et cetera, are all part of that. So the scientific community, I think, has migrated to using climate change to describe that realm because global warming is just one part of it. The science hasn't changed, just the language being used.
John, thank you for your call. We have an email here, Laura, that you'll be interested in. This is from Christine. She says, it's also hard to trust when the CDC, an organization created to keep us safe, covered up for 50 years of scientific evidence that lead was dangerous in products, but the lead industry used money to keep the truth from the public. Is this something you followed?
I did not follow that, but I think that it's a really important point to note that is the skepticism of whether it be pharmaceutical or government about what the motives are and whether or not there are capitalistic motives behind the science that we bring forward. And also, you know, reiterates Peter's point that there are bad apples and there are bad circumstances that do happen, and hopefully they don't color the vast majority of scientists out there.
Okay, we're going to go to Matthew, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Matthew, go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer, thank you for taking my call. Thank you for the panel and this great discussion. Quickly to a comment and then a question. By background, I'm an ordained congregational minister serving a congregation here in the greater Bangor area. And I just wanted to say how encouraged I am. I'm seeing, at least in my experience, the once kind of large bridge of polarization between what I would call the faith community and the science community actually closing. In my denominational church calendar, we have days that are set where we celebrate Earth Day, where we celebrate, make people aware of issues like global climate change and animal endangerment. And I was just wondering what your panel might speak to or give suggestions to ideas that would continue maybe that conversation and closing that gap between maybe the two communities. I appreciate it, and I'll actually hang up and listen off.
Okay. David, do you have thoughts on the changing nature of the link between religion and science skepticism? Right. Is it changing, or does it depend on what religion you are?
I imagine it depends, you know, on what religion you are and where you are, and I'm certainly encouraged to hear what the caller said. You know, in terms of his question about practical things, what comes to mind is, and it's more of a general thought, but I think it's really easy to ascribe science skepticism simply to ignorance. And I think that is something that historically, you know, scientists have sometimes or maybe frequently done with religious doubts altogether. But there are very often understandable, if not necessarily correct, reasons why somebody will doubt the science. And as Laura was saying before with vaccines, it is important to, you know, meet those people where they're coming from and to recognize that, okay, even if they're wrong about a particular piece of science, they may be wrong because of a system of values or beliefs that have served them well in other areas. And I don't think we stand a chance of bridging the gaps if we deny that.
I'm reading from, we posted on the MPBN Main Calling Facebook page, Atul Gawande's speech to Caltech this past Friday night to the graduates there. And one of the things he talks about, the cultural domains that are, he says, some are religious groups, those challenging evolution, for instance. Some are industry groups, such as with climate skepticism. Others tilt more to the left, such as those who respect the medical establishment. As varied as these groups are, they are alike in all way. They harbor sacred beliefs that they do not consider open to question. Very interesting that this is not right or left, that there are sacred beliefs on both sides.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, getting to those core common human values. I mean, we as humans have a lot of important things besides just accuracy in determining what's accurate, and getting to those core common beliefs and having conversations that speak to those beliefs using the data that we have to support or refute. To support those beliefs is I think, essentially important when we have conversations about science.
We're going to go to Jerry, who's calling from Smithfield. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. One comment and like a response. Seems to me that panel programs on NPR oftentimes try to be so balanced that they affect the opinion. And for instance, 96% of scientists support climate change, about 4% don't. But oftentimes you'll get a person from both sides being interviewed, and it gives the impression that it's a 50-50 opinion. So it sometimes affects the opinion of people listening that it's not really a strong problem. You comment on that, please?
Yeah, I think you've brought up a good point. And I think that it's something everybody in the media struggles with all sorts of issues, is trying to strive between being balanced in a story, but presenting a balance that is really reflective of the knowledge that's out there. And, you know, this is something that's perpetually debated in journalism schools and in newsrooms all over the country. And at some point, you know, everyone does their best. But I think also we have to hope that the audience is intelligent and takes the information it's given and uses the information that's better, that everybody is a responsible citizen and you know, isn't sitting there with a stopwatch measuring how much time one side is given versus the other and which one I'm going to give more credibility to based on that. I will acknowledge, Jerry, that this is a really big issue in journalism. Is this something you've looked at, David?
Not this particular thing. I mean, what came to mind when the caller was talking was sort of a related issue, which is that, I mean, I don't envy science reporters because it's a tough thing to try to, I think, fairly and completely represent this sort of the really complicated, messy, long-term, you know, and varied enterprise of science, right? So I can't speak to specifically, you know, whether 96% of guests, you know, support sort of one thing. You know, I mean, you know, I sort of will defer to you there, but I do think science as a thing, I think, is pretty hard to represent, you know, quickly and fairly and easily on the air.
And I think that's why the caller's point is so important, because certainly the vast majority of scientists seem to support the concept of climate change, and the vast majority of physicians support vaccinations, and the vast majority of Americans are vaccinating their kids. I think that's a very important point, that even while we debate these smaller realms of skepticism, we still have some pretty important majority concepts that are retained from in the scientific community.
If I would just say, the one thought I have is the element of time is important. So if it's a story that doesn't run that long, you hear that there's a preponderance of opinion one way, and then you hear the contrasting opinions. When it goes on for months, years, or decades, you lose the fact of that imbalance, and all you constantly see is two heads on the TV or two opinions, and what you feel like is it's a much more divided argument.
Jerry, thanks for calling and making your point. We're going to get to one more, and this is a Facebook post from Victory. It says, could the panel please comment on how much of science skepticism can be attributed to stubborn anti-intellectualism among the American people altogether? I think people are generally skeptical of information they may not be able to immediately check for themselves. I think this is a big discussion, and maybe not one for the end of the program, but thoughts?
Yeah, well, it could be. I think I see that wrapped up in the tribes chosen, particularly on the political side. And so, yes, but I'm not sure that that's the motivation. I'm not sure it's class warfare. I think it's more of a the political contrast that we've become so much more divided, now become entrenched and can be interpreted different ways.
I've certainly found in my research, those that are skeptical about vaccination are highly educated. Stubborn, I'm not quite sure, but they certainly aren't anti-intellectual. They've done a lot of reading and a lot of thinking, but their motivated reasoning has led them to believe something that's different than the scientific community.
Okay, and the historian, is anti-intellectualism, it's not just a contemporary phenomenon,
no,
is it?
No, it has pretty deep roots. But like Ivan and Laura, I'd be a little bit skeptical about attributing too much to ignorance and anti-intellectualism, because you can find plenty of people who vaccinate their kids who don't understand how vaccines work, right? Plenty of people who believe in climate change who don't understand the science, right? So I do think that we have to look to how people understand science generally, right? Whether they are skeptical of it or supportive of it, and not just sort of like congratulate, pat ourselves on the back if we like it. That it might be about just how people process complicated information more generally, that sometimes leads people to accept it and sometimes not, you know, but I'm not sure ignorance is really the answer.
And Ivan, and I want to talk about going back to the idea of sort of folks who are in colleges and universities and looking at sort of pure science and looking at how they translate that pure science to the general public. Is there more work being done there so that the conversation is there work being done on helping scientists talk to the rest of the public?
Yes.
And regular people language?
Yeah. In as far as outreach and decision support kinds of disciplines, there's a lot of work being done on, there's a phrase, couple social ecological systems, talking about how science and human systems are working together. So that's a very big area of research. And our challenge really is to be able to maintain the core disciplines that we've always had, as well as add these new disciplines in order to interpret them and get the job done that we're supposed to be getting done. But there's no question, there's a revolution in how I think we study and we teach students and we engage students on that.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you so much. What an interesting conversation. That was Ivan Fernandez, a professor of soil science at the University of Maine. He does work on climate change. Laura Blaisdell is a pediatrician with Intermed, whose research is on attitudes toward vaccinations. And David Hecht, an assistant professor of history at Bowdoin College, where he teaches about the history of science. John Keimel ran the board today. Abukar Adan answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. And tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about the restaurant industry and the national discussion over wages and fair practices, along with many other issues facing the industry and its future. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.